Welcome to the Think Christian podcast. I'm Josh Larson. We're back to our usual format this week after some recent watch party fun. Fresh off of revisiting Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, we're going to dig into a couple of new pieces of pop culture to explore how there's no such thing as secular. Michael Jordan has dominated the sports landscape in recent weeks, much like he dominated the 1990s. With no live sports on TV, ESPN's The Last Dance, this 10-part documentary series that focuses on the Chicago Bulls and basketball legend, it became a pop culture phenomenon, even for those folks who normally care nothing for sports ball. Part of this, I think, was due to the candid interviews with Jordan, where he doubled down on the confidence and the competitive mean streak that he was known for in his playing days. Watching Jordan bask in those glory days, it made me think about the Christian virtue of humility. Now, humility, it's never been a word used to describe Jordan. If anything, he's something of a fascinating counterexample. And I think he gives us a way into considering humility in general. Fellow NBA nerd Catherine Freeman and I are going to talk about that. Now, you can hear strains of humility on Reunions. This is the new album from Jason Isbell and the 400 Unit. Eric Danielson, a big Isbell fan, is wowed by this one. And he also appreciates its vision of humbled masculinity in particular. He'll be on a little bit later to chat about Reunions. Before we get to that, I wanted to share a quick Apple Podcasts review of the TC Podcast. We received this from Z Hesting. Thoughtful discussions that never fall into the trap that most Christian criticism falls into, judgment. I love the inclusiveness of the debates and the not always obvious tie-ins to Scripture. Well worth a listen. Thanks to Z Hesting for that review. If you'd care to leave one on Apple Podcasts, just scroll down on our show page in the app and you can review us right there. Really does help us out. Also, if you want to send any other feedback directly our way, that's what our email address is for. Go ahead and email us at tcpodcast@thinkchristian.net. All right, now that we've spent a little time bragging, let's get on with this humility-themed show, first by talking to Catherine Freeman about ESPN's The Last Dance. Catherine, in a parallel non-COVID-19 universe, you and I are enjoying the NBA Finals right now. Clippers versus Bucks would have been my preference. I don't know. What were you hoping for?
I would say maybe Lakers versus Bucks. Like, I would love to see a Giannis-LeBron Finals. I would have loved that.
Okay, fair enough. And it looked like it might have been heading that way. But unfortunately, that's not the case. And though obviously this is an insignificant hardship compared to what many people are going through, I do need to know how you're coping with having the postseason of the world's best sports suddenly taken away.
It's been hard. I was talking to a friend about that the other day. Like, we've been trying to find other sports to get into, and I feel like The Last Dance has been the closest I've gotten to feeling a little bit of what I would be feeling if we were watching the NBA Finals.
Yeah, same with me. And I think the fact for me, at least, is that I've been doing it live. I mean, obviously, after each installment aired, you could go back and watch it. But I've been doing this for the last, 5 weeks, every Sunday night. ESPN, thankfully, they pushed up the release of this. It's a 10-part documentary series. So they've done two parts each Sunday night. Has never before seen behind-the-scenes footage from Michael Jordan's last season with the Bulls, 1998, and then sprinkles in these contemporary interviews with him. And I've just gobbled down every episode and enjoyed having that structure to my life, which live sports provide too, right? The game is going to happen at this time. If you want to watch it live, you got to be there. And so that's kind of been completely independent of the content. One of the things I've really liked about it. But what about the series itself, Catherine, in terms of what was in there? What's your basic reaction? What did you make of it generally?
I liked it. I enjoyed it. And I'm wondering too, for me, like, if part of my enjoyment is because it's not the finals and like it provided that ritual, that communal, that sort of escape that we're all missing right now. I don't think I would call it a documentary. I think that it's hard to get really at truth when the story is so closely affiliated. And a lot of people have talked about the close affiliation with Jordan, but I would say even the NBA and like the idea that you're crafting the narrative. Jordan turned the NBA to a global brand. And so they also have a vested interest of him coming across it being this huge juggernaut on ESPN and Netflix. And I think in some ways, some of the editorial choices, I think, reflect that truth. But as a Sunday night thing during the pandemic, I loved it.
Yeah. Yep, for sure. I'm there with you. And you're right. You do have to keep that in mind. Jordan essentially had, I don't know if you could call it final cut, but this all came about because he finally agreed to the release of some of this footage. And he agreed to sit down for these interviews. And that's how the ball got rolling, you know, how much he was involved in the questions that were thrown his way or what scenes were put in the final result. I don't know. But yeah, you've got to keep in mind that he's heavily involved and influential here, as is the NBA. So no surprise, he comes off, I would say, as this historically great champion. But you got to say, he comes off as a huge jerk as well.
Oh, yeah.
And this is coming from a Chicago area kid who was in high school and college during Jordan's championship. So prime years for my sports fandom. You know, I should be a sucker for this sort of stuff. And maybe it's because I was well aware of this side of him years before. This wasn't shocking to me. But wow, watching the way in this documentary, even, he still holds grudges decades later against these players he battled with. The footage we do get of him berating teammates in practice for not being able to match his level of excellence. And then even in these contemporary interviews, he routinely expresses his confidence in his abilities, you know, his confidence about his place in history, and scoffs at anyone who dares to question it. So it's not a puff piece. Though you do recognize that he's still allowing the information to get out that we do see. It's kind of up to him. But I want to be fair too, Catherine. I think he makes some gestures towards humility. I want to get your reaction to this. He does talk about Coach Phil Jackson, his coach, and how he got him to understand that he would need to involve teammates if he wanted to win at the highest level. And Jordan himself, you know, he points out he didn't win a championship without Scottie Pippen. Very early on, he makes that clear. So I don't know. Did these moments, though, did they strike you as genuine humility, Catherine? Or do you think Jordan just understands he kind of needs to say these things for his image, but he doesn't necessarily believe them?
I think that, to me, I would not call those takes humility. I think even those comments can be put in the context of like Jordan and excellence. Like, I don't think he thinks, I think his idea of like excellence, like, okay, Phil Jackson, I think a lot of people would say is probably like one of the greatest coaches in the NBA, right? And so, and I think someone who consistently, even though he has a very sort of zen-like presence, is intensely competitive, is really smart, really analytical. And so I think with Phil Jackson, at least, to me, those comments came from a place of like respect, not necessarily that Michael Jordan was humble. And I think even with like Scottie Pippen, like in the beginning, I think in one of the first couple of episodes, he said, whenever anybody speaks my name, they should speak Scottie Pippen. But then over the course of the 10 episodes, at lots of points, he took pot shots at Scottie Pippen about not matching his like competitiveness, his like his toughness. It's kind of like you cannot in one breath say like you respect this person and then go out of your way. It seemed like in a lot of instances, go out of your way to like just make it clear that you're actually still above this person. Like that's not really humility.
No, I think that's true. And I think you're absolutely right when you describe it in terms of he is recognizing that both of them were able to meet his level of excellence, which isn't exactly the same as sharing some of the credit, right? Yeah, I think that's fair. I did have some sympathy for him, I want to say, around episode 6. And this is the episode that spends some time on the gambling scandal that erupted during one playoff run. Basically, he spent time at a casino between games. A book came out detailing all the money he'd lost gambling in casinos and on golf courses. And he has this moment where he talks about all of the bad press he got for that and how he felt about having these expectations for himself as a public figure. And he kind of says, what was I expected to be? I think the phrase he uses is the purest of the pure. And that really jumped out at me, you know, just like that's kind of religious language, isn't it? And this acknowledgement that I was never going to be able to be that. And it's not long after that where he does make an admission. I think he says something like, he insists I don't have a gambling problem. That may be questionable, but he says he doesn't. What he says is, I have a competition problem. And, you know, by episode 7, when we start to see how he's talking about he would invent snubs from others just to motivate himself. That story about George Karl, the Sonics coach in the 96 finals, wouldn't say hello to him at a restaurant before a game. And so he used that as a snub to motivate himself in his performance. This is what I learned watching it, Catherine, even though I grew up on Jordan. It became clear to me that he played out of anger, not joy. And you don't necessarily always see that in the clips because he is absolutely the most aesthetically beautiful player of all time, the most aesthetically beautiful, just watching these clips of the way he would play the game and the balance and the athleticism, I wouldn't have guessed that it was powered mostly by anger, but I think that's what we see here. Is that a fair way to characterize the way he played?
I am not going to be a Jordan apologist, but I feel like anger is too strong of a word.
Okay.
I do agree with the competition thing. I think Phil Jackson maybe said in one of the episodes or in some other interview, having coached both Jordan and Kobe, which I thought was really profound, that, you know, both Kobe and Jordan had this thing, we were going to be the best guy on the court. And he said the only difference is when Kobe stepped off the court, he went back to like normal things, like wanting to be normal life, regular kind of guy. But Jordan was like, stepped off the court and it's like, I want to race you to the car. And so I feel like it's that. I believe, maybe this makes me naive, but I do believe that he does have a competition problem. And I do believe that is why you've seen consistently, like, he retired once, he played baseball, he came back, he retired again, he came back and played for the Wizards.
Yeah.
I think because he had such a singular drive for excellence in that arena, it has made it hard for him to find that same feeling in any place other than basketball. To me, I feel like he created those like petty arguments to motivate himself, not from a place of anger, but because I think, you know, at that time, when you're so far above other people competitively, like I can see the tendency to want to slack off and be like, you know what, I can get 50% and still be the Seattle Supersonics, you know? And so I feel like it was maybe not from a place necessarily of anger, but of like motivation and making sure he never took his foot off the gas.
Yeah, that makes sense too. And it's still, however you characterize it, even he would admit it, it is a problem. And I think as a problem, it kind of stands in contrast with something like humility. And I don't mean just, you know, humility as a character trait, but as a Christian virtue. I think we could describe humility that way. We think about how we're encouraged by Jesus in Luke 14 not to exalt ourselves. He also says those who humble themselves will be exalted. Think about Philippians 2, where Paul describes Jesus explicitly in terms of his humility. That's where Paul writes, being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. So here's a really tough question that I've been thinking about. I don't know if we'll be able to answer, but I want to talk it out with you. That sort of humility I just described, do you think it's possible to hold that in any way? Kobe Bryant, you mentioned, maybe this is partly an answer, but is it possible to hold that sort of humility on the basketball court, especially if you might be the best who ever played the game? I don't know. What do you think?
I'll give two answers to that. I think you can. I think particularly if you're a Christian who plays basketball and loves competition on any field, I think that wherever you go, you're called to like represent Christ. But I think of something, especially with Jesus and Paul using them as examples, where they could have claimed, you know, at other points, they make all of these claims about, Paul talks about being a Pharisee of Pharisee, and yet they didn't. I don't know. There's something so inspiring. And I think it's very countercultural, this idea that like you have all these credentials and you should be able to just like lay them on the table and be like, you know, like I'm Michael Jordan or, you know, I'm LeBron James. And yet they don't. And so I feel like it is possible. You know, we grew up in our family Celtics fans, mainly because of Bill Russell was like the guy when my dad was growing up.
Okay.
And so I just, something to me that will always be the ideal, I think, in terms of like athletics, just like the gentlest, had to deal with so much as an African-American man in Boston at that time, but just was so gentle, so excellent. And I just think that it is possible, or even like LeBron, like I'm not going to act like LeBron doesn't have his moments. The meme of him yelling at J.R. Smith, you know, I've seen it, but I just think that there is a way to like encourage your teammates. I mean, the thing is, like, someone brought this up with LeBron James. Tristan Thompson and J.R. Smith are still living off contracts he got for them, in contrast to like Jordan and Scottie Pippen and like people knowing that Pippen was underpaid. And so I just think that there's some aspect of like, yes, you can be excellent. And, you know, Jordan has every right to claim every accolade, to claim he's the greatest of all time. And that's fine. But I also wonder about like what it cost him. Like, I think my big takeaway is the emptiness. If you don't have that competition, if it's always only you and you only can feel something when you're putting other people down or excluding people, And maybe he's not like that in every aspect of his life, but maybe it just is when it comes to basketball. So I'll say, someone who doesn't know him, I don't want to make a judgment on his whole life, but you just see, like, I don't know, people make fun of LeBron James because he has such a camaraderie with his contemporaries. But I just think from the outside, it just looks more joyful. Like, LeBron James loves to play basketball. I feel like I would want that more than the just like one time he didn't say hi to me and one time he like looked at me.
Well, you talk about the cost, and I think we see that in the documentary. There is a scene, and I think it might be after the big 1998 championship, his last championship that the whole documentary is built around. He's in the locker room, and he's going around individually to people, congratulating them, which for Jordan is almost a humble gesture because he's specifically saying, wants them to know he appreciates their contribution. Yet, I noticed how each person, except for Scottie Pippen, was kind of skittish, almost like they didn't know what was going to happen. Like, he would come up to them to give them a high five, to say a congratulatory word, and they looked scared. And it just kind of took me aback. Like, in this moment, when you should be celebrating with your teammates all in one accord, instead, their reaction is to flinch from you. That was kind of striking to me. And so, I guess in considering that question, it made me wonder if you can only really be humble at this level if you recognize your talent as a gift. And if not, if you recognize it as something that's just something you earned or you achieved and you're fierce about protecting it and not losing it, humility isn't going to be an option. And maybe this is something like a gift is actually a curse for him situation to be this talented. It's a curse because you look at that moment of his teammates seeming to be afraid of even talking to him. And I think there is a cost there. There is a loss there to it, as great as he is. And you mentioned Bill Russell. I think it's worth mentioning, Catherine, too. That's a name, along with LeBron and along with Jordan, I see most often in the debates over the best of all time. It's frequently those three, I think, who people will argue about. And yeah, Bill Russell before my time, too. So I can't really speak to his, to the way he played, but the way you've described it, it does seem in contrast for sure to what we've seen of Michael Jordan, at least in The Last Dance. Anything else about the documentary you wanted to cover?
Yeah, and I was just going to say, I mean, the thing is, like, he deprived himself of these relationships. I remember being struck by the fact that him and Steve Kerr shared this thing, right, where their dads were killed by seemingly random acts of violence. Them asking Steve Kerr, have you ever talked about this with him? And him saying, no, we've never talked about it.
Yeah.
And it might be because it's too painful for both of them. But I just thought of, like, when you were having those moments of just, like, profound grief, part of what helps is other people who understand and can empathize. And I just think, what would it have been for him to be able to, like, share that, to have that kind of relationship with Steve Kerr? Here's someone who completely understands what it is to, like, love your dad, to be so close, to be a big, your dad to be a big part of why you're even on this stage, and to lose them in the seemingly very random way. Like, what would that have meant for him in his process and his grief? And so I can see how it hurt his teammates. He was hurt by the decision to treat them the way that he did.
Yeah. Loss of relationship there. And you have to wonder if something like not having that conversation with Steve Kerr, you're right, there could have been many reasons why it didn't happen. But if there was a fear maybe on Jordan's part of appearing weak, because that would have been the gist of that conversation is, hey, I am wounded and hurt here in a way that you are. Maybe to go back to the competition problem, he wanted to believe he was also the most wounded of all time. You know, like if you can't imagine sharing your excellence, anyone being as excellent as you on your level, maybe you can't imagine anyone hurting as much as you either, which, to go back to your notion, ends up only hurting yourself because you're bearing that pain all alone. So yeah, not just a sports documentary by any means. We've been talking, you know, psychology and theology.
Yeah.
And I did really enjoy it overall. I'm so glad that we got to talk about it. There's enough in The Last Dance that we also wrote about it on the TC website. Joshua Coldagelli, he wrote The Bulls and the Body, which focuses on the team dynamic that, you know, even Jordan, I think, needed to win and how that resembles the body of Christ. Catherine, you've been writing for Think Christian as well. We recently published an article of yours about the Michelle Obama documentary, Becoming. So lots of good stuff at thinkchristian.net. Thanks for writing that, Catherine, and coming on the podcast. Always good to talk NBA with you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was fun. Humble me.
was the late, great Sharon Jones and her amazing band, the Dap Kings, with Humble Me, a smokin', soulful song that really plays like a prayer, from a singer that didn't catch her big break until she was in her 40s. Maybe it takes spending your adult life working as an armored car driver and a guard at Rikers Island Prison in New York to know what it means to really be humble with the gift of music. If you don't know Jones' story, check out the 2016 documentary Miss Sharon Jones, which chronicles her final months battling cancer and continuing to perform. That song, in fact, comes from the soundtrack to that excellent film. And it could be from the soundtrack to this episode of the Think Christian podcast, couldn't it? Well, I guess it is. Hello, this is John J. Thompson, your musical aggregator, collator, and tour guide. And though I certainly don't want to brag, the 30-song playlist I've pulled together for this episode of the podcast really doesn't stink at all. There are some excellent songs out there that contemplate failure, need, humiliation, brokenness, and all of that humanness most of us try to avoid talking about. You'll hear from quite a few well-known voices, including Amy Winehouse, The Killers, with a brand new track about the prodigal son, no less, The Beatles, Dawes, Isbell, of course, The National, Ella Fitzgerald, Fits in the Tantrums, The Gorillaz, who you'll hear from a little bit later in the show here, and many others, as well as quite a few names that I'm sure will be brand new to you. The Spectators, for instance, are an indie band from Chicago that I've been playing over on my True Tune Spotify mixtape for a while. I think they should have broken into the big time by now. Take a listen and you'll see why. Their song, When My Humanity Starts Showing Through, just knocks me out. I'm sure you know how this works by now, but just in case, to listen along, just search for the Think Christian profile on Spotify and follow it. You find this episode's playlist on the latest episode, and you can also see it listed as its own mix separately, and you can hear all of the mixes I've curated for the podcast there, either individually or on the archive list. You can also find the links in the emails you get from us or at thinkchristian.net. And if you think of any great songs that touch on the theme of humility, tweet at me, at John J. Thompson, and I'll see what I can do. Until next time, this is a profoundly humbled JJT, thanking you for listening and respectfully inviting you to turn it up.
Happy to bring on Eric Danielson again. Eric, the last time you were on the show, we discussed an artist who was relatively unfamiliar to us, Grimes. At least you knew more about her than I did, for sure, I'll say. This time, we're talking about a favorite artist of yours, though, Jason Isbell. Can you give us a little background on him and talk a little bit about what you appreciate about his music?
Sure. Well, some folks first became acquainted with Isbell when he was the third guitarist and third songwriter in the Southern rock band Drive-By Truckers. He eventually left that band, maybe too gentle a way of putting it. I believe he was asked to leave at that point because he was really struggling with his sobriety kind of back in the mid to late 2000s. But since, I think, 2007 has put out a string of records that I think only grow in esteem. And kind of the record that really, I think, introduced him to a larger audience was Southeastern from 2013, which is really the album that documents him getting sober, falling in love with his now wife, the musician Amanda Shires, and kind of salvaging what was left of his life and really turning his life around. And that's really where I came to Isbell. I knew some of his work before that, but was kind of peripherally aware of him. And that record is just, for anyone who's ever heard it, is just such a gut punch of emotion and grief and lament, but also has these wonderful, hopeful tones to it. And so I've been on board ever since. I mean, I feel like he's one of the great songwriters of his generation. I'm not sure, he may have crested that hill that I'm about to crest and turned 40 at this point, but I think for a while was calling him the greatest songwriter in America under 40, because I think there's really nobody other than, you know, kind of the Mount Rushmore figures like Dylan and those who are still around that touch him in my mind as far as the quality of his work.
Wow. Yeah, it was the post-Truckers work that kind of put him on the radar for me, though really through friends who just loved him. Reunions is probably the first time I've really dug into an album of his myself. And I think those comparisons make sense now, even though they are lofty ones, because what really impressed me is his talent as a storyteller, this painter of personal experiences. Sometimes it sounds like what you've just described are his own, but also sometimes getting into the heads of other people and bringing their experiences to life. And I do think there are some interesting connections there in some of those stories to this idea of humility we've been considering on this episode. But I want to start, Eric, with the early reactions you shared on Twitter about Reunions. Here's what you wrote: listening to Jason Isbell's Reunions for the fourth or fifth time since it hit the atmosphere Friday. I could write a whole book, how about a short thread, about the sort of masculinity his songs reject, the vision of manhood he furthers, and how I long to see myself in it. So maybe you can just give us a gist of that thread. I know there's a lot packed in there, a book's worth, apparently. But maybe give us a little sense of what you mean, Eric, and talk about a song, possibly on reunions, that particularly captures that for you.
Sure. I probably should have labeled that thread with, you know, spoiler alerts for this podcast, but I didn't think I had to do that.
No problem.
No, I think over the course of Isbell's records, and certainly with this one, I've just been increasingly struck by, you know, you hear a lot about great Southern rock artists, for example, who are kind of deconstructing the South in their songs. They are acknowledging what's great about it, but also dealing with a lot of the myths there and a lot of, you know, unfortunate things that have happened there systemically and individually over the years. And I think he does that with masculinity and manhood. The men that he, you know, is critiquing in his songs are those who are measure their strength in might and power and being able to lord it over other people. You know, they're men who don't apologize for what they do. They're men who, you know, just kind of run roughshod over other people. And the vision of manhood that he seems to present when he is seems to be singing from his own point of view or not about someone else is someone who is humble, who apologizes, who considers other people's needs, who's willing to own up to his own mistakes and say, if I can make this right, if I can make you whole, I will, you know, so kind of displaying a real genuine sense of repentance and restitution there. And so I just really love that about him. I think that he's projecting a sort of manhood that honestly is more in line with what we see in the manhood of Christ than unfortunately in a lot of Christians. And I think one song that really illustrates that on this record is one of the lead singles, which is the song Be Afraid. And I know I was talking with you about this a while back, but the song, you know, it's got the big guitars and the big chorus that you would expect an anthem to have that says, you know, don't be afraid, just go out and do what you do. Don't let anybody, you know, kind of hold you back. And what Isbell is saying in that song instead is, if you don't reckon with your own fears, if you don't reckon with your own insecurities, and then love people anyway, you're never going to be any good to anybody. You know, if you have to be honest about the things that are holding you back, you have to be honest about your shortcomings. And in a sense, I feel like the song almost kind of echoes, or at least has kind of some of the same beats as the Sermon on the Mount, in which, you know, Jesus is saying, no, it's not like you think. Blessed are those who, all the people that the world would reject, those are the people who are blessed. And I feel like that's what Isbell's saying here, is he's saying, blessed are you, you know, if you are honest about who you are, if you're afraid, if you're awkward, if you're anxious, all of those things, but you go out and try to care about the people around you anyway. I just really love that. I think that's really consistent with the message that he has been unpacking little by little over the course of, you know, maybe the last 4 or 5 records. We've been testing you and you failed to see how long that you could hold it in before you scream, but you only exhale. I don't think you even recognize the sound of your voice when it's blasting through the speakers in the sky. And if your words add up to nothing, then you're making a choice to sing a cover when we need a battle cry.
So as you alluded to, Eric, it does take humility to shed some of that traditional masculinity that you're describing. I guess we could call it that. And I wanted to talk about another song that I think also espouses humility, maybe in a slightly different way. And it's the album opener, What Have I Done to Help? There's a great bass line to this, first of all, that I absolutely love. But it's also really interesting lyrically. It strikes me, you know, right now is a time when we're in need of great humility. You think about COVID-19 doesn't discriminate, but really we can in our response to it. And I know this is really complicated and often comes down to individual decisions and scenarios, but I do think one question we're having to ask each other and ourselves is how much are we willing to humble ourselves when it comes to our comforts, comes to our sacrifices, in order to ease the suffering of others, or maybe I should say, minimize the risk of their sufferings. And What Have I Done to Help sounds to me like the confession of a man who has been unable to muster the sort of humility that I'd argue the gospel does call us to offer. I think of just this part when he sings, the world's on fire and we just climb higher till we're no longer bothered by the smoke and sound. Good people suffer and the heart gets tougher, nothing given, nothing found. Now that word tougher, I think that brings us back to the masculinity idea that you mentioned, Eric. And I have definitely noticed, again, each individual situation is different. I don't mean to paint with a broad brush, but I've noticed a manly aversion to, for one example, wearing masks, despite overwhelming advice from health professionals of how important that is right now. Interestingly, I've seen a number of times where there'll be a couple and the woman is wearing a mask, but the man isn't. And again, who knows what the particular reasons are there, but it does paint this picture, this kind of stark picture of what masculinity might mean in that situation. Especially, you know, the point of wearing one is to protect others from yourself. And so it certainly kind of counts in some situations as an act of selfish pride not to wear one. And this is where Jesus' gender is really interesting to me because of the way you described the album when we were initially talking about this. I've had this in mind. And, you know, as our model, certainly in the Bible, he presented an image of masculinity that wasn't rooted in pride, and it wasn't rooted in something else that you've already touched on, dominance. It was rooted in sacrifice, and it was really rooted in humility. So, you know, when Isabel asks, what have I done to help? I think we can ask ourselves the same thing right now. And then we have Jesus as our guide for what we should at least be aiming for. What'd you make of that song, Eric? How did that sort of fit in with what we've been talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's everything you've said is a really beautiful description of what that song is about. And I think that whether it is out of pride or sometimes fear, or, you know, sometimes the line between the two is almost, you know, impossible to tell, but our instinct can so easily be to protect ourselves, to protect maybe our families, or even to have this inclination of protecting our nation at all costs, but not seeing how that sense of self-preservation, or maybe just trying to save face in the example of maybe wearing masks, kind of literally and figuratively, keeps us from caring for other people. You know, we put up these walls and our instincts are channeled into taking care of ourselves. And there's just such a stark contrast with, yeah, what we see in Jesus' presentation of himself and in his exercise of his own humanity, that he had all the privilege in the world. He had all the rights in the world to say, I'm not getting my hands dirty with these people, but he gave all that up. He put all that aside and he said, this is more important. Love is more important. And so I think, you know, what Isabel's saying on that song and these questions that you're talking about that we're all dealing with, it's really important for us to wrestle with, where am I living out of self-preservation and fear and trying to maintain what's comfortable and safe for me versus, you know, what does the world around me need? What do I owe the people who I'm around on a daily basis?
So we dug pretty deeply into two songs there. As we kind of wrap up, are there any others that popped out to you about the album or anything just unrelated to what we've been talking about that you want to point out about reunions? I think the one song I'd throw in real quickly, because it's such a storytelling example, is Dreamsicle. This kind of memory of growing up with a troubled home as a kid. And there are just some descriptions there that I can see right in my mind's eye as he's singing about them. But there are any other songs or anything else about the album you wanted to touch on?
I'll briefly mention two songs that I really love. Dreamsicle's great. That's one of my favorite songs on the record for sure. One is the song St. Peter's Autograph. And my understanding of that song, I tend to believe the attributions on the site Genius. So I don't know if this is accurate or not, but the idea that it was a song that Isabel wrote for Amanda Shires, for his wife, after the guitar player Neil Casal died last year, who was a friend of hers. And he just has some very priestly lines in that moment or in that song where he's talking about, you know, your response to this grief, part of it's how you were wired. And he literally kind of says in that song, like, you were wired this way, but that's all right. Part of it is how you were raised, but that's okay. And just kind of saying like, it's okay to be yourself as you grieve. And I think there's a very beautiful priestly duty that he's doing there for his wife. But the song that just gets me on every listen late in the track listing is the song, It Gets Easier. I won't get the line correct because I don't have it in front of me, but he begins the song. Anyone who's been with him for years now knows that it has maintained sobriety. He begins the song by talking about having dreams multiple times a week about drinking and waking up from those dreams and how this process is still challenging and still, you know, has this grip on him. But as the chorus goes, it's easier. And again, I think, I mean, that lyric is staggering in and of itself, but just going back to this broader context that we've been talking about, you know, I think sometimes American men are raised with this notion that we don't let people in on the process. You know, we don't let people in on the struggle and the mistakes that we make. If we're going to present ourselves to the world around us, we present ourselves as confident and fully formed and, you know, not lacking, you know, anything. And Isabel in that song is willing to say, like, yeah, I'm doing good, all things considered, but it's still really, really hard. And you need to understand that I still have these moments where the world seems to kind of shift off its axis a little bit. And I wonder if I'm going to keep this good thing that I have going. And so I'm just grateful for the vulnerability, which is not a new thing for him, but the vulnerability in a song like that. And I think listening to those songs again, it makes me feel like it's empowering to me to say I can make those confessions to people. I can make those admissions. That would actually be good for my soul rather than the opposite.
And not even knowing all of that history that you shared with us for Isbell, I could still feel it in that song, in It Gets Easier. I just kind of knew that from, not because he's explicitly taking us through a narrative arc, but yeah, just the way he's expressing that and what he's sharing in his music. So thanks for filling in some of those details for us, Eric. I hope you get to see Isbell live in concert for a whole variety of reasons. I hope we can all get out to a live concert sometime, but sounds like that would be pretty special for you. I imagine maybe you've seen him already a time or two.
I was going to say, I think I've seen him three times at this point, okay, because he's kind of a return visitor to a festival here in our community. And I would just say that anyone who's never seen him, you should go when and if we get the chance again soon. I don't think people often realize this because he's such a great songwriter. He is a terrific lead guitar player and ends up trading solos with the guitarist in his band, the 400 Unit, pretty much through every song. And so it's just kind of this, he turns up the amps and it's a tour de force live. So it's really fun.
All right. Well, here's hoping there's a chance sometime soon for people to get to do that. Thanks again, Eric. And yeah, we'll talk to you down the road about another album. All right.
All right. Sounds great. Thank you.
Good to hear Damon Albarn, the lead singer for 90s British pop band Blur, still putting out new music as Gorillaz. The virtual, often literally animated cohort behind that 2018 track you just heard, titled, yep, Humility. Such great chill to that song. And I have to say, when I manage a bit of humility, I feel pretty chill. When I'm puffed up with pride and worried about protecting my elevated status, not so much. Usually that makes me kind of anxious. Thanks to Eric Danielson and Catherine Freeman for helping me chill out on this episode and for reminding me of what biblical humility looks like. They'll do the same for you if you follow them on Twitter. Catherine is at Catherine Annette, and Eric is at Eric Danielson. Eric is spelled A-A-R-I-K. Thanks also to John J. Thompson for putting together another Spotify playlist for this episode. If you want to give it a listen, just search for the Think Christian playlist on Spotify. You can also find TC on YouTube now. For those of you who enjoy listening to podcasts that way, and way more people do that than I realized, just search for the Think Christian podcast on YouTube. Nothing too elaborate there, but our post-production supervisor, John Reeder, has designed a nice package that gives you all the audio you need and lets you see our smiling faces. The Think Christian podcast is a production of Reframe Media, a family of programs designed to help you see your whole life reframed by God's gospel story. Visit reframemedia.com for more info. Our audio engineer and post-production supervisor, that is John Reeder. Reframe's co-director, overseeing content strategy, is Robin Bassman. Thanks so much for listening. We'll get together again soon to consider how another aspect of our pop culture fandom connects with our faith. One last note, thank you to the Communication Arts Department at Trinity Christian College in Palos Heights, Illinois, which provided the recording space for this episode. You can learn more about Trinity at trnty.edu. And go Trolls!